Welcome to the CSIS Cogit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colin Quinn, and we'll start as we always do with the region's news. In Beijing, China announced that the new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or AIIB, will aim to differentiate itself from other multilateral lenders by utilizing a voting structure that allows a greater voice for developing countries. The articles of incorporation will reportedly also grant China, the AIIB's largest shareholder, a veto over key decisions. In Seoul, the Blue House announced Wednesday that President Park has postponed her planned visit to the United States to continue managing South Korea's response to a viral outbreak of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. Government and health officials believe they have traced those exposed to the disease and placed them in isolation accordingly, with 3,439 Koreans now in quarantine and almost 2,500 schools and universities closed to contain the outbreak. 9 people have died in Korea thus far, with over 100 confirmed infected with the virus. It has also spread to China, with 1 confirmed infection and 75 people in quarantine who have tested negative for the virus. In South Asia, India's special forces carried out a cross-border operation into Myanmar to target a militant group which killed 18 Indian soldiers at Manipur in India's Chandel province last week. The Indian Army stated it acted on intelligence to prevent future attacks, which were being planned by a mixed group of Meitei and Kaplang militants in northwest Myanmar. In Tokyo, the results of a joint survey conducted by South Korean and Japanese newspapers show that 73% of Japanese think that South Korea is not trustworthy, while 85% of Koreans say Japan is not trustworthy. The survey was conducted ahead of the 50th anniversary of the Japan-South Korea Basic Relations Treaty signing on June 22nd, highlighting the wide gap in perceptions over history between the two countries. In regional economic news, Japan's first quarter GDP growth was revised upwards to 3.9%, which was well above economists' previous estimate. Driven by surges in corporate investment and capital spending, this unanticipated development marks Japan's best quarter in 2 years, boosting hopes of a continued recovery from the recession that followed a consumption tax hike last year. And that's the news. In last week's show, we reviewed Ash Carter's announcement at the annual Shangri-La Dialogue. After that stop in Singapore, Carter visited Vietnam and then India, where he renewed the US-India Defence Framework Agreement and met with Prime Minister Narendra Modi to discuss the future of security cooperation between the two partners. CSIS Wadhwani Chair Richard Rossow joins us to assess Carter's visit to Delhi and explain what it means for US-India defence relations. So, Rick, Defence Secretary Ash Carter was in India last week agreeing the Defence Framework Agreement along with some other agreements that were in the pipeline but were brought to fruition probably a little quicker than people expected. Could you explain what happened there?
Well, the Defence Framework Agreement was going to expire at the end of June, and so they had actually negotiated the language for this several months ago and finalized the agreement when President Obama visited India in January. But they wanted to wait until we had a new defense secretary in place before signing that. So I think we all knew that signing the defense framework agreement was in the pipe and pretty certain to happen during the visit. But since the visit, of course, we actually got to see the substance. And, you know, for the most part, it's a renewal of a lot of the existing language and plans for engagement that we saw 10 years ago. But there are some subtle areas where we've kind of expanded it a bit. I think the most interesting of those is we talked about collaboration on the use of common defense platforms, which they don't really expound too much. But, of course, a lot of the work we've done here at CSIS is talking about the savings that can accrue to governments if we actually commit to using similar defense platforms. So hopefully we'll be able to move forward on some of these new areas that were explored, as well as some of the areas that were in the last 10-year agreement that never really kind of came to fruition, such as missile defense. There might be more we can do there, but we never really even began to touch on that over the last 10 years. So signing that agreement was a big deal. But yeah, as you mentioned, I think we were surprised that, you know, of the 4 co-development projects under the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative that were highlighted when President Obama was in India, that we've actually signed agreements on 2 of those. The 2 that we're going to begin moving forward on the most quickly, one is on a hazardous material suit for battle troops, so for chemicals and biohazards. The second is going to be a battery or an energy pack particularly for use in forward deployment bases, so you don't have to do resupply quite as much. So what these ultimately are going to look like is a little bit difficult to say at this point, but we've come to agreement on moving forward with those two. We've got two more near-term projects. One is roll-on, roll-off kits for the C-130 transport aircraft. And then, you know, fourth, we're looking at a small drone. But there's two other co-development projects, too, that were discussed during the visit that are a little bit further away, but I think have helped to get the Indians engaged. One is some type of aircraft carrier technology, and the second is jet engine technology. So again, not very well defined what ultimately these two are going to look like, but that's really the hook to get India engaged today, is show them that indeed we're going to open up the doors for some pretty exciting stuff a little bit later on.
And you're saying that this is, you know, a lot of these are renewals of agreements that were going to expire. So could you say that this is increased engagement, or is this kind of keeping things ticking over?
Yeah, I think for the most part, defense among probably all the agencies in the last 7 or 8 years has probably maintained the highest level of engagement with India, even through the downturn that we saw near the end of the UPA government. So, for instance, a few of us were invited over to the Pentagon to have dinner with Secretary Carter before he went out. And, as think tankers, you'd like to come up with something novel and interesting to say during that conversation. But frankly, most of us were just talking about, different people to engage with, different ways to kind of shape and frame and describe what we were doing with India, rather than coming up with new areas of engagement. Because generally, I'd have to say the Pentagon is getting a lot of things right in this relationship. They're starting, and we saw this on Secretary Carter's trip, we're starting with things that India wants today. They want access to technology, and they want a stronger defense manufacturing base. And the hopes that this idea that we have similar values and an alignment of perceptions on global order, that eventually once India has the tools and capacity to become at least a regional security provider to a greater extent, that they'll do that. So I think, the Pentagon by and large is kind of getting the relationship right. They're not pressing too hard on the gas. They're offering things today that India would be responsive to, and hoping that, we're playing the long game, that further down the road, India will step up and play a role in its interest that takes a little bit of pressure off the United States to be all things in all places.
How was Secretary Carter's visit viewed in India? I mean, what is the appetite on the ground there for perhaps a bigger defense posture?
Well, I don't think he was pressing them to take a bigger defense posture per se. So what he was coming and offering on this trip were all things that India wanted. And they know, Secretary Carter, so this Defense Technology and Trade Initiative that we started with, when that was originally created, it was called the Carter Initiative. Carter, as the Deputy Secretary of State at the time, was anointed the titular head of this group and really began its work. So he's viewed in India, frankly, as one of the strongest proponents of a stronger U.S.-India relationship. The language that he uses, the tenor that he uses when he's there, is not about trying to get India to commit troops to battle ISIS or something like that. And instead, it's just helping India to get the capacity to do things in its own interest. So there again, believing that our interests are broadly aligned, India having the capacity, and we've got some recent examples of that with the evacuation from Yemen, with the earthquake in Nepal, where India stepped up, helped get Americans out of those places, and got people on the ground even before the rest of the international community could get there. So we've actually seen some instances about how India can play this role.
And there's obviously other close allies in the region of the U.S. How would countries like Pakistan view this increased engagement, increased cooperation?
Yeah. Pakistan creates an interesting issue when we talk about co-development of technologies, when we talk about strategic trade with India. So I think that's exactly the right question to ask. I don't think there's any other allies we have in the region that would show concern, but for Pakistan, it's definitely a concern. I mean, it's an interesting scenario right now where Pakistan still views India as its main strategic rival. India no longer views Pakistan in the same lens. India is looking at China. China's not looking at India. China's looking at the United States. So you've got this strange daisy chain of countries that are chasing each other without there really being a competitive dynamic, in both ways among them. So, we want to work with India. We want to partner with India. We want to find ways to help India produce more, to be able to buy more interesting and novel technologies. But at the same time, on a good day, Pakistan is doing helpful things in the war on terror, and that's not every day, and it's not on every front. But, for instance, the campaign they've been conducting in Waziristan for the last year plus has actually resulted in a dramatic downturn in cross-border terrorist attacks into Afghanistan, which is our primary interest in engaging Pakistan. So this idea that we would close the door altogether to Pakistan, you know, few people have the appetite to do so. So we want to make sure that we maintain good relations with Pakistan right now. That's at least the current U.S. position. And so there might be a limit to what we would do with India first off. But at the same time, you know, we do understand that India is not looking at Pakistan as its rival. And when we think about parity in the region, when we think about India's importance as a strong weight in Asia, it's not to counter Pakistan. So I think we're slowly coming around as well in terms of how we view India in the region and who we view India's relationships with as more important. For us, we want India to be big and strong, to provide a positive role in South Asia, to facilitate in case there's disasters like we saw in Nepal, but also, you know, so other large growing countries in the region think about India as a as another powerful weight in the region when they make their own strategic calculations.
So this U.S.-India cooperation, it seems like a case of, you know, smart policy well implemented. Is there anything more that you'd like to see? Is there anything that you could see as a next step then in this relationship?
Well, you know, a lot of it, I think, has got to evolve around making sure that India is able to commit to this in the long game. And this is what I wrote about my most recent piece, which is if we're leading with things that India wants today, we need to make sure for our own national interest that there's a payback tomorrow. And it's not a payback where we have to get India to promise they're going to take specific actions. But just the fact that, you know, we've seen a dramatic uptick in our bilateral relationship under Prime Minister Modi in India. But he's not going to be in office forever. And, you know, whether he, you know, he's in his 60s already, whether in 10, 15 years he steps down, or in 4 years or 9 years or 14 years when India has its next national elections, if the BJP gets unseated, what's the alternative there? And are we going to be able to maintain the current trajectory of relations? You know, we saw this when the Congress government was in power, that the elected folks that we engaged with, Prime Minister Singh and his colleagues, you know, we got along with quite well. And in the initial years, we were able to move forward on our strategic engagement. But ultimately, the party's boss, Sonia Gandhi, president of the Congress party, she had very different plans and where she wanted to spend her own political capital. And it was definitely not on things that furthered U.S.-India relations. So what if Congress comes back to power? What if Rahul Gandhi takes over as the leader of the country, whether as president of the party or indeed as prime minister someday? You know, would he continue the trajectory that Modi has really began to engage in? Right now, I'd say a safe bet is to say that no, he won't. Should we be doing things today to get him and his most trusted advisors more in line with the benefits of partnership? I think we should. So I think there are things that we should be doing, but more of that is just protecting ourselves against a dramatic course change that we might see, particularly through political change in India.
Illuminating stuff, Rick. Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
And that was Rick Rosser. Now we turn to our one to watch for this week. This past weekend at the Women's World Cup in Canada, Thailand lost its first match to Norway 4-0. There was no shame in losing to Norway, former World Cup and Olympic winners. However, it marked the first match since 1938 for a Southeast Asian country in a World Cup, men's or women's. When Indonesia was still under colonial rule, it participated in the 1938 men's event as the Dutch East Indies. It was soundly beaten by Hungary and eliminated from the tournament after its opening match. While it was the first Asian team to participate in the World Cup, future qualification has eluded Indonesia. Subsequently, no Southeast Asian team had qualified for the World Cup, men's or women's, for 77 years, which would be remarkable, even if many Southeast Asian countries were not the football-crazed viewing areas they certainly are. Unlike Northeast Asia and Oceania, the football teams of ASEAN have struggled to qualify for the world's biggest tournaments. When Thailand's women play Cote d'Ivoire in their second match on Thursday, they have a chance to record the first ever victory for Southeast Asia at any World Cup. Here at CSS, we'll be watching. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Also, check out our island tracker and maritime-specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.